all our gods and goddesses are shown with weapons in their hands. That is not for ornamentation. That is for attacking what you think is adharm. Gandhi said, you know, I'm not talking about political stuff. I'm going to talk about Ram Rajya and its establishment and how it's so important and how non-violence is important and all that. And then he steps aside and Savarkar takes the podium saying, what is absolute non-violence? Even to establish that Ram Rajya, Ram had to go to Lanka and kill Ravan after waging a war. He didn't go there and sit on Satyagraha saying, give Sita back. And he said, okay, chalo, I'll give her back to you. And even in the Gita, it's your duty, your dharmic duty to kill the person if that person is on the side of adharm.
So you feel all of this, having Mahatma Gandhi on the currency, right? It's largely because of political gain. On Figuring Out, we talk about future and how can you build a better tomorrow to achieve all your dreams. But you cannot build a better tomorrow if you don't understand your past, if you don't understand the history of where you come from. That's why in today's episode, we have the historian Dr. Vikram Sampath to talk about the history which we have not learned in school. We've talked about the ideology of Veer Savarkar versus Gandhiji, why there's focus on just Mughal empires, not on any other empire, why in India we've always been taught about history of Delhi, not about the southern region, not about the northeastern region. Why there's always focus on British empires and India losing in every battle. We have tried to uncover these lessons from the past and the ideologies where we come from and why there are certain things which are still the same from the history. And if you feel that history is really boring, then today's episode is for you, because we have tried to make it super interesting from somebody who's a historian and talks about real facts. Also, if you feel that podcasts are super long, then you can check out our clips channel, Rajshamani Clips, where we have tried to cover all the clips and the interesting topics in different genres. You'll get to learn about politics, business, startups, history, future, and so many different topics which will make you really a smart mind and be prepared for tomorrow. Please check out the channel and enjoy today's show.
All right, I want to pick up on something, because I think your career started because of movies. I mean, sort of.
Yeah.
Serials, right? Like that's what it started, right? Because you saw a fiction on a television, right? And that's how I think in modern times most of the people start thinking about history or get fascinated by history, because we see some of the other movie and then we like, wow, we want to get more into it, we want to understand more, right?
Yeah,
I saw like everything. I started with Legends of Hanuman to enter. Like I got super fascinated by everything, what they were showing and how the whole animation worked, right? And then I recently saw a series called Taj, that actually led me to think more about and read more about what Mughals did, right? Then there was one Sardar Udham, that was again something which took me to okay, aur janna hai, aur karna hai.
Right.
So I think these movies play a like huge role in sparking that curiosity in you and making sure that you're studying about a lot of these things, right?
Correct.
So what's your take on certain movies is which I want to ask. Okay, there are like certain movies in India which have had crazy adaptations. So one of them is Bajirao Mastani. What do you think about?
You're going to get me in trouble. If I ever want any of my books to get adapted by those filmmakers, it will depend on my answers here.
No. No, of course. You'll get the right person to, you know, make a movie on one of your books.
So that's I mean, you see, I think overall, Bollywood, the way they look at history is, and it's no value judgment. It's just that they look at historical characters also largely by yardsticks of today. Unnecessarily, there has to be a romance angle fitted into it. There has to be some song and dance sequence which is unrelated. So many things, like even Bajirao, I think though it was cinematically very beautifully done, and Mr. Bansali, of course, is a master, you know, storyteller and filmmaker. But, you know, the the takeaway for the audience is like Bajirao was all but a romantic hero. Yeah. And he was pining for her, Mastani's love. And people, of course, the flip side is a lot of people went to Pune and Shaniwarwada and saw the palace there and so on, which nobody would go to. So some curiosity was generated. But Bajirao was much more than that. He was one of the greatest of the Peshwas before the, of course, the Panipat War. After that, you had Madhav Rao. But Bajirao the First was someone who established the Peshwa, the Maratha Empire. You know, if after Chhatrapati Shivaji Maharaj, there was someone, it was him. So for someone like that, who had his, how he needs to be remembered is not as a lovesick Romeo, but as a great warrior. Yeah. You know, so that becomes an unintended consequence that everyone is concentrating only on the Mastani angle of his life, which even chroniclers of that time have not really gone so much into the depth of the personal lives and so on. So that is an unintended and sad consequence when the movie Masala is added into, I think, while it makes the characters accessible and maybe human, the problem is this, that what remains in people's memory is probably just as in the case of that serial, if someone who's seen that Sanjay Khan episode, if you ever say Wodeyar, they'll remember that fat king who is, you know, dancing with a court dancer, almost emasculated, that sort of a thing. So it's a very potent medium to create lasting impressions in people's minds about characters. So I think the responsibility of the filmmaker, the script writers and all that is all the more, intense as to how they portray these people. And that is why most historical movies end up with controversy, whether it was Padmavat, whether it was Jodha Akbar, even Bajirao also, I think, had some. So because people are sensitive about how their heroes and heroines are portrayed. So that, I think, they need to take extra care and caution to see that the facts are adhered to or whatever, however they show, is to the maximum extent backed by facts, because you are perpetuating that person's legacy and image in the minds of people, particularly the youth of the country.
There are a few movies who were well received by the audience, and they showed like the bravery, the wars and everything of that sort. I don't know how true or false that is, because my understanding is only limited to the movies, because that's how we get to understand history in today's world. One of them was Tanaji.
Yeah.
Do you think that movie, what they showed, was the real side?
I've unfortunately not seen the movie, so I wouldn't know. But I heard it was comparatively a much better
adaptation.
Adherence to the original, facts of history. It's a very tight, difficult game. And I think that is one reason why filmmakers also shy away from period films. One is, of course, they're so costly to make, to recreate that era, the sets and all of that. But along with that, they know that, unless you get this element right, it can lead to a lot of backlash.
True.
So though Indian history is so full of so much of drama, so much of intrigue, romance, battles, conspiracies, they don't form part of, filmatic adaptations in India. At least in recent times. In regional cinema, it's much better, whether it is, South Indian cinema in Kannada or Telugu and Tamil and all that. Many of these heroes and others have been portrayed, and those have somehow managed to stick to the original essence of the person, and they haven't led to so much of, backlash and controversy as probably Hindi cinema does.
Do you remember any Hindi movie or any movie for that matter in India, which you felt like, okay, this is one of the good adaptations.
Of a historical?
Of a historical movie. Any movie which you liked?
To be honest, no.
So movies play an important role, and you feel in movies, they should be showing a holistic version of the essence or the protagonist instead of just one side of the protagonist, which shapes.
No, I think a lot more care needs to be taken into the research element when it comes to a historical figure. Look at multiple sources, get a proper historian on board as a period consultant or an expert, and actually ensure that all the, elements are well laid out and the character of the protagonist comes through. Of course, I understand, you know, it's a different medium. So cinematic adaptation, there is some creative liberties that one need to take, but it needs to be within the boundaries of acceptability by and large.
Yeah.
Very tough to define it. It's a very intangible commodity, but still it needs to be to the maximum extent, well researched, backed with evidence. Then people will not like, if maybe one movie which you say not made in India, but the Gandhi film, which Attenborough had made.
Hmm.
I mean, all through there was, of course, there was a little bit of dramatization and so on. But still, it didn't deviate so much from the main theme of, you know, Gandhi's life. And we all got an essence. And I think the world got an understanding of what Gandhi was. I think he became a global brand more because of that film, right? And when it went on to win Oscars and all the awards it won, it created a different essence. And it's so unfortunate that we needed a foreigner to make a film on the father of the nation of India. And all the Indian movies on Gandhi have not done so well, right? So many people have made films on him, right? From Shyam Benegal to others. But those have not created that kind of an impact. We can't even remember the names of some of those as much as Attenborough's Gandhi and Ben Kingsley. So world over, everyone thinks Gandhi was this handsome, charming man like Ben Kingsley was. so
interesting. But I feel though in movies, they only show one side, or maybe they focus on, and they don't care too much about the character or whatever for that reason. I think it's important because if it was not for movies, I would have never been interested in history at all, because schools made it so bad. Like, there was my history teacher, okay? I forgot her name, but I can still see her. Like, in my eyes, she's there. She used to take the pen in the middle of fingers and then she used to do this. Because I would not remember ki 1947 mein kya hua, 1965 mein kya hua, 1826 mein kya hua, like just random dates. Because it was just that too much. They never painted a beautiful picture the way, you know, the movies show, or the storytellers, or the the likes of what you're doing right now.
So is the trauma playing out when you're talking to a historian today? Childhood trauma?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I remember I got once, I was punished and I was thrown out of my class because Battle of Panipat ke upar koi question tha, or I didn't remember. And it was just
which
so
of the
bad.
Three? You know there were three?
Yeah, I know three. I know there were three. That I know by heart now. But that is how it started. So if you were given an option, would you change the way history is being taught in school?
Oh, yes.
Or in syllabus, like what would you add and what would you remove completely?
No, I think everything. I mean, it needs a complete change in the way it is, you know, structured. One is, of course, as I mentioned earlier, our history itself, as you might also remember, it's so focused and centered around Delhi and North India.
Yeah.
And when you say history of India, I think every part of India needs to get a place in it. We know so little about, do we even know about the Northeast kingdoms? We've not even heard of some
Never
of the names.
Of.
Yeah. So like the Wodeyars of Mysore, who ruled for 600 years. In the Assam, you had the Ahoms, who again ruled for 600 years. And throughout that period, they kept Assam invincible for any kind of foreign aggression. But you ask any child today, or even, you know, non-children today, name a couple of Ahom rulers or one Ahom ruler or something. None of us would even be able to, you know, bring that to our recollection. So does that mean those people were not part of the history of India? Or does Assam doesn't belong to this country, or the Northeast does not belong? Similarly, South India doesn't feature in the manner it should. I don't know if the books have changed now, but when seen last, the NCRT books that are there, which people can, you know, download from the website freely. In one of the class 7 or 8 or something, you know, the only reference to Chhatrapati Shivaji Maharaj is a photograph with a caption below it saying whose photograph it is. So a young child growing up in India knows about someone as iconic as him only that much. So the Marathas also given hardly any space. The Cholas, the mighty Cholas, who ensured we had a maritime trade and also maritime conquests as far as Southeast Asia, Sri Vijaya and Maldives, Sri Lanka and all these places, they probably take half a paragraph or one paragraph in the current books. The Vijayanagar Empire, all these great empires and dynasties, they don't get the space they require. And, the overemphasis, whereas in comparison, you'll have three chapters on the Mughals. So every child in India would be able to, memorize and also narrate the succession lines of all the Mughals.
Yeah.
The same cannot be said of a Rashtrakuta or a Chola or a Chalukya dynasty of South India, because that is not given importance. These are all, sidelined as regional histories. Now, what is regional? What is mainstream? Is Delhi mainstream? Is every other part of India just a small little subservient part? Can the Maratha Empire, which was so vast, that actually the British took over India not from the Mughals but from the Marathas. So for 100 years, the whole of India was virtually under the control of the Marathas, from Attak to Katak, as they used to say, and up to down south till Rameshwaram. They had such a vast, sphere of influence. But how much of that translates into understanding for a child who's growing up? Right. So their understanding only limits to Baji Rao and Mastani and the love songs and all of that. So so while I agree that, history is not just a list of dynasties and kings and queens, even when it comes to people's histories, do we know so about the various indigenous tribes of Northeast India? 400 plus indigenous tribes, they have so many different dialects, languages, very different musical instruments, dances, food, cuisines and all of that. Those also don't form part of the larger theme. So I think one is to make the history of India more interesting, to include all parts of India, to give as much importance to men and women, which is what I have tried to do in my book, Brave Hearts of Bharat. And also to, one more major flaw which I see is, even if you remember, all the battles that are listed or we study growing up are a long laundry list of battles that we lost. Right from the Greeks and, Alexander, invading, to the Shakas, the Huns, then the Arab invasion of Sindh, then the Turks, Ghazni, Ghori, then you have the Mongols and then the Timurids, the Mughals who came in. Then you have, of course, all the Europeans, Portuguese, French, the British, the Dutch. So everywhere, one after the other, the battles of Panipat that you mentioned, Battle of Buxar, Battle of Plassey, the Battle of Tarain. You have the Anglo-Mysore Wars, Anglo-Maratha Wars, Anglo-Sikh Wars. All of it, the common feature, India and Indians lost. So today, if we are still around, as the only pre-bronze era civilization which is alive, there must have been some battles we won also.
Yeah.
Some courage that we showed also as a civilization. So which are those battles? Who are those heroes and heroines who put, a defense and resistance? I think that needs to be a holistic, sense. Because according to me, history is not just a discipline. While, like you, even I hated it while growing up, as you grow older, you realize that this is it's not just a subject which you ratta maro and then try to pass exams or whatever. But it is a mirror in which you can identify yourself as a nation, as a civilization, as a people. It gives you a sense of identity. It roots you to your identity itself. And so unless we have our roots firmly in the ground, we really cannot chart a future for ourselves. And today, when India is so poised to expand its wings and grow in all ways, militarily, economically, and so on, and population-wise also, unless we have a clear understanding of our past and a narrative of the grand Indian narrative. In the 5,000 years or whatever of recorded Indian history, what was the contribution of our ancestors to human knowledge in various fields? It could be, mathematics, chemistry, alchemy, metallurgy, medicine, yoga, wellness, you know, mind, body, soul connection, philosophy, linguistics, phonetics, every field, you know, sciences and everything. Unless we get that sense that, you know, these are the aspects that we can be genuinely proud of our ancestors and their achievements, both militarily, both in the production of knowledge, because we've always been a knowledge seeking society. Yeah. So unless we get that, we will be a very rootless civilization. Our future generations, we may become the third largest economy, we may have the nuclear bomb, we may have many other things. But if you do not have pride for your own nation and where we have come from, all of that, I think, becomes very futile. And I think China understood that well. And they built the large, you know, the larger Chinese narrative, the grand Chinese narrative. Good or bad, I'm not, you know, getting into that, you know, considering it's a dictatorial communist regime. But the understanding of the past, the main takeaway from that is an understanding of the past is so essential to chart a glorious future. So to that extent, that is what a school textbook needs to do. Rather than create, you know, people like us who have only nightmares about our history teachers and history classes, it should be an enjoyable thing which takes you on a fascinating journey into your own past and everything that it has to offer and give you hope for the future.
So do you feel that, I think, now that we're talking about it and we all admit that history needs to be taught in a better way, do you think that our government is now taking initiatives to include history in a certain way, or they're not doing it at all? Because it has been this problem, if you have identified, if thousands of people identified, I go through the same problem, right? I'm sure like a lot of people must have identified this problem. But over the years, don't you think the government tried to change something? Because if the whole history was just about Delhi, it was not inclusive of the whole country, right? There has to be some agenda, some narrative by someone who's painted it, right? But now that is being carried forward too.
Yeah.
So do you think that it's time that we change it, or do you feel that government is doing already something to change it?
I don't think so. Because unfortunately, I don't see, though there have been a lot of talks, including by the current dispensation, that there needs to be a change. They have instituted committees and all of that to gather information from different parts of, you know, crowdsourcing of information. There was a parliamentary standing committee also under Dr. Vinay Sahasrabuddhe, which, you know, collated all these information from different people. But finally, the proof of the pudding is in eating it. So till the time the books actually change, which shouldn't take so long. I mean, it takes maybe 6 months to put a bunch of, you know, 10, 12 scholars into a room and say, hey, listen, we need to have a different view. Yeah. So unless there is a strategic thinking, an overall idea, just changing for the heck of changing it is not what it needs to be. Add this, remove this. So we have all these controversies, remove Mughal history, remove this. Those type of things are meaningless because you can't wish away your past.
Yeah.
What has happened, I don't like XYZ, that doesn't mean you just remove that person. You have to show the good, bad and the ugly to the student and let that person, let the young person decide. We don't have to undermine the intelligence of a young person in India at all, saying this is what you need to read or that you should not read. So I think, so governments of the day, they are so ridden with bureaucratic, you know, the way they go around, that I think this doesn't seem to be priority for them at all, unless it becomes a people's movement and people say there's more and more outrage on the people's front that we don't want our children, our grandchildren to read a distorted version or an incomplete version of Indian history. The governments will just continue doing what they do. They have other priorities, you know, defense of the country, ensuring the economy is in order, so many other things which are much higher on the agenda than school textbook of history. So I wouldn't completely blame them, but civil society also needs to take up that you know, responsibility.
It has to be a movement.
A movement where, especially through online mediums like this, which reach out to so many people. I mean, if there's a petition on petition.org or whatever, where people, you know, 10 crore people just sign up and say, we want a more inclusive, a more honest and a more undistorted version of our history taught to our children. more the numbers. Governments, political parties, politicians only respond to numbers and vote banks and, those kind of things. So democracy is finally a system of competing lobbies. So so if this is something important for you, you need to lobby for it in the right way and get the action done. Otherwise, expecting them to have the knowledge and the sensitivity about every little thing is a little unrealistic.
Interesting. So, okay, I'm just going back to the one level before we actually completed this. You said a lot of our textbook includes Mughal and we kind of know a lot of Mughal leaders, but not other leaders, right?
Yeah.
And for fortunate, unfortunate, whatever reason, why do you feel it's there? Because I remember I've been taught about Humayun, Akbar, Shahjahan, Aurangzeb, right? And it goes on.
Yeah.
So just why Babur, like I don't even remember so many names, but yeah, these are the most amount of names you would remember from any random person in India who would know maximum about just Mughal history.
Yeah.
Why do you feel like is there a reason that we just read so much about just Mughals?
So I think, particularly after independence, the education system itself and was in the hands of several people and it was largely, I think, textured by ideological tilts of the Marxist kinds and the Aligarh Muslim University, and the kind of HRD ministers we had, from Nurul Hasan to Maulana Azad to so many others, who ensured that, it was the aftermath of partition. Hmm. This country was partitioned on communal lines. And the violence, the bloodshed that followed, where so many, lakhs and lakhs of people were displaced, lost their lives. And there was an animosity towards a particular community because that was the basis for the partition of the country. So these people felt, rightly or wrongly, in retrospect wrongly, that, all the uncomfortable aspects of Indian history need not be told. And this included particularly the Islamic conquests. For about 800, 900 years, the rule over India was from, Central Asia, Middle East, all the Islamic rulers. And someone like an American historian, Will Durant, has called the Islamic conquest of India as one of the bloodiest tales of human history. Not just Indian, but human. Professor K.S. Lal, a historian, has estimated that just in 500 years, between 1000 CE and 1526, when the Delhi Sultanate was established, something like 8 crores was the population of the subcontinent, which declined. So 8 crore people, a genocide of so many largely non-Muslims, was committed here. You had historian Sitaram Goyal, who said something like a minimum of 40,000 temples being destroyed. A very, conservative estimate. And we see that everywhere. The Qutub Minar, so many, monuments were built after destroying local, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, shrines of worship. Women from this subcontinent were taken away to distant lands as sex, slaves. Even at the height of the Mughal Empire, you had things like the jizya, the tax that all non-Muslims had to pay to even live a respectable life. And jizya formed, I think, almost 15 to 20% of the revenue of the Mughal Empire, even at the heights of its glory. And under Aurangzeb, how the iconoclasm, where everything from Mathura to Kashi, Vishwanath, all these temples were broken. Now, but post-independence, particularly under all these eminences whom I mentioned, it almost became imperative that let's not talk about all this. Let's put all this under the carpet, because this is very uncomfortable. This is talking about all of this will upset today's social harmony, which I don't know why it should. Because I keep saying this time and time again, a young Muslim man or woman today in India is not responsible for what Ghazni and Ghori and Aurangzeb, Tipu Sultan, all these other barbarians did. Similarly, we should try to dehyphenate today's communities from all these invaders. And though a lot of them, several people glorify these, barbaric leaders, including, you have political parties and their people going to the mazar of Aurangzeb and offering tributes, whereas imagine, in Germany or Israel, you have a monument in honor of Hitler and people, the Jews are asked to go and offer tribute. So something similar here, where there are a lot of people who glorify these people, which should not be, allowed. And we need to de-hyphenate communities, tell them that these are not your heroes. Your heroes, you were as much a victim of the atrocities that these people committed rather than, whitewash their crimes and present a very, very sanitized version of history. Because when you throw things under the carpet and think that it did not happen at all, I think truth has a very uncomfortable manner of resurfacing. And when it resurfaces, it creates social tensions. So time and time again, I keep mentioning that the edifice of national unity, of social cohesion, it cannot rest on the shaky foundations of whitewashed history. It's a very, very loose foundation. At the slightest breeze, it will fall down. So instead, tell the truth as it is, without any, fear and favor, whatever atrocities, oppressions, there were caste oppressions, there were these Islamic conquests, talk about all of them. And the idea for the future should be, one, you should learn from these mistakes, that these will not be committed again. And we need to move forward, heal the wounds of the past. We are a wounded civilization. And so we need to heal those wounds and move on with a positive outlook for the future. Assuming that the wound never happened will make the cancer grow, rather than eliminate the wound. So in India's history, particularly, that healing process, I think, has not happened. Instead, we glorify these people. As you say, there is more emphasis on a lot of these people who came from the outside.
Yeah.
And they may have been born in India and all that, but still their affinity was from where they came from. And that's so natural. If you come from some place, you have a more affinity for where you invaded from. So I think that closure when it comes to historical topics, we need to look into. World over, you have the Holocaust museums.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean people are celebrating the Holocaust. You go there, you revisit those horrors, and you make a pledge that we will not allow this to happen again. I think that sort of a closure we need in India. If that doesn't happen, then history will become a battlefield, which it continues to now. Every now and then, whether it was a Ram Janmabhoomi case or whether, now this renaming of different places, all these fissures will keep erupting. Because as I said, if the foundation is shaky, the building cannot stand. It will collapse at some point, and that will lead to social unrest. So while the intentions may have been very good, while all these syllabi and so on might have been, formulated that in the aftermath of partition, we need to do this and that. But in the long term, it doesn't help the country. And I think that cognizance is what, historians and curriculum creators and government and everyone need to accept and acknowledge.
Okay, turning the gears, you met PM Modi.
Mm.
Right? How is meeting PM Modi for you?
Yeah, I met him a couple of times, and I think each
couple
time...
Couple of times now. Tell me, each time what?
Each time was quite a great experience, because I think, I'm completely not affiliated to any political party.
Of course.
Or in any way, directly or indirectly. But I saw in this man a kind of passion, a kind of, the aura and the energy that he exudes. He's one of a man on a mission, never resting, constantly active. I remember one of the meetings that was there went on for 3 long hours. And while a lot of us who are probably half his age kind of zoned out. This man was constantly on, and he had already at the end of a long day, he had had 3, 4, 5 engagements already. And post this meeting, there was 2, 3 more for the rest of the night. And despite that, someone who was active mentally, physically, of course, but mentally also, and at that age, to be able to do that, speaks of a lot about the man's commitment for the country and, you know, the cause that he believes he's working for. And the other, you know, inspirational thing that I see is the amount of hatred that is hurled at him. But for anyone else, you know, and as a historian, I get probably one small fraction of the amount of hatred he receives. And it rattles me. It, you know, sometimes now I've started slowly growing a thicker hide. But there's so much of hatred, allegations, all kinds of things, because anyone who speaks the truth is a heretic. So it upsets the existing apple cart. And so that is a problem. But I always wondered, what does this man do to actually not be affected? You know, it's not easy when people are constantly hurling negativity at you to actually keep your energy field clean enough out of all of that. I think it needs some amount of, without spiritual sadhana and so on, you can't do that.
Who do you think like can make a great PM apart from the, like, who do you think is a good candidate for PM?
Oh my God.
I'm just asking like my personal curiosity.
I think maybe Yogi Adityanath would be quite an interesting person to see there. Of course, it's going to create ripples across the world that, you know, a saffron-clad monk standing at the UN General Assembly and talking will be quite a sight to behold. But yeah, if that's what destiny has to offer him, so be it. Let's see how that goes. Because yeah, he's turned around UP in such a big way exactly. In the last 5 years, and to control that state is no mean task. You know, the kind of law and order situation where the mafia would run amok and people's lives, whether it was women or men or whoever, the kind of things that we saw earlier is not what it is. And infrastructure development and all of that, that is there. I think he's doing pretty well. If someone can control that kind of mess, would be much better to control a larger country like India, which is so chaotic.
Yeah.
I think it needs to be a combination of both development. We look at only development, but also who can, you know, hold
the country together.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe he's probably.
You know, also I love like what he recently did and trying to at least do that. He's trying to look at state's development and process the way corporates look at their businesses.
Yeah.
Right. He's getting PwC or Deloitte to think on strategies and stuff. Like that is unheard of. Like never heard of this, that state is now getting consulted by the big force of the world.
So I think that's sort of healthy, you know, like between corporates, competitors, trying to see my state is better than yours. I think some of that is coming up now in even social indices, like the Swachh Bharat mission and the survey that goes, all the cities are ranked, right?
Yeah.
So for the longest time, I think Indore tops the list. So I've been to Indore just a couple of weeks back, among many other, you know, trips to the city. I see that sense of pride even among the common people that hamara shahar jo hai sabse swachh shahar hai, and people also participate in this movement. It can't be a top-down approach of government doing everything. It has to be bottoms-up, where people also are not throwing kachda on the street, they're not littering. So though they have all their Sarafa Bazaar and those street food things, you see an element of cleanliness which the people have also, you know, come up, and they want to maintain this. We want to be the number one city in this index. So I think those that competitiveness in a nice way, just like how the corporates do, is what would lead to profitability for the corporates and good governance in the case of states and cities.
Just a fun fact, if you didn't know, I'm from Indore.
Oh, so that's why you fed. I didn't know that, so it was not to massage your ego at all.
No, I'm from Indore. I moved to Bombay 2 years ago. And I've been part of this movement of Swachh Bharat.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And everybody in Indore feels so proud.
Yes.
And I've seen that change in front of me, because as when you're a kid, you are telling your family, your relatives, your friends and their families, ki achha nahi kachra mat feko, aap utha lo. And we used to be, my group, my friends and my sisters, we used to be one of those, if somebody throws litter on the road, we would just pick up and put it, right? And we would hold it, and we would hold, we would teach our parents that if humne toffee khai hai, we would hold that wrapper till we reach our house and then put it in dustbin, right? So we would do that. Yeah. As kids, I think everybody does that.
Yeah.
But then slowly the whole city started doing this. And yeah. I saw this change. I saw that people are not throwing litter anywhere in the city. And they were picking up other people's litter.
And Mysore is another city, I think second or third in the ranking. And I see that even there, the amount of pride. And there's always, why is Indore taking the lead? We should do better. And I think that is where people who, you know, politically simply oppose Mr. Modi and his policies, and which is legitimate right of in a democracy, people have to oppose, someone has to be in government. But they don't understand that a lot of things that he has done have thus become people's movements. You know, it was not as if he designed Keep India Clean. Even under the previous regimes, there were this movements of, you know, open defecation free ODF schemes, building public toilets and all that. But the reach and to actually involve people, as I said, this can't be just some babu sitting somewhere and passing some, you know, paper here and there. Unless people, jan bhagidari, if it doesn't happen, I don't think these schemes can work. So one of the biggest reasons why he's so successful even electorally is he's taken a lot of people into several of his movements, and the Labharti, as they say, you know, in their, it's become a community of their own. I mean, all those different schemes they run to give gas cylinders and, you know, toilets, especially for women and so on in rural areas, water to every home. So these type of things are something that touch people's lives, and then the support base obviously grows. So how does someone counter that? You can't say these things are not true, because the numbers are there, the people's lived experiences are there. As you said, from Indore 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it was not the case, right? This was not the feeling in the people of Indore.
Recent.
Yeah. So what, who is driving that? What is the scheme that is, you know, driving that? So someone just goes and disparages a Swachh Bharat Abhiyan. An Indore wala will never vote for that person, right? Yeah. And say, who are you to tell me this? I mean, we are seeing the change on the ground, and you don't even know the reality, and you are disparaging it. So I think that becomes a problem, where I think very nicely they have combined all kinds of things, social engineering along with some of the development schemes and all of that, which is what is helping them grow electorally, election after election.
Interesting, very interesting. But now
we go back to history.
We go back to history, but no, more than history. I was just saying that now their area of winning regions is now decreasing. So it was up till last electoral season, there were only 21% of India was not controlled, or, you know, like was not under BJP.
Yeah.
Now there's 37% of India which is not under BJP.
Which is good. Which is very good, I think, because for two reasons. One is, I think it punctures that horrible and very perverse campaign that was going on nationally and internationally that democracy is dead in India, that everything is rigged and so on. So if democracy was indeed dead, as even people like that nefarious, you know, Soros and others who went around parroting everywhere, the ruling party would not give up important states like Karnataka or Himachal or whatever. So the very fact that the ballot has the capability of overthrowing governments, even of the dominant political party, shows that we are a thriving democracy. So people who are doing this kind of campaign, I think it should shut their mouths forever.
Yeah.
That you can't disparage our hard-fought freedom and democracy for your petty political gains. The second good thing is that it keeps this ruling party also under check, you know, on their toes all the time. Otherwise a degree of complacency develops, and you think, take people for granted too. So we need, as I said, that's a healthy good thing that, yeah, we need a combination. We need a healthy and a good opposition who can challenge the government and also overthrow governments. I'm from Karnataka and I know that there was popular discontent against the government there, the incumbent BJP government, and we saw the results the way it did a couple of weeks ago, which is a wake up call for all these parties, because they all just think that 5 years you don't do much work and then just encash the popularity of Mr. Modi or just have his road shows and this and that, and then you can overturn misgovernance or public discontent of several years. I think that is living in a fool's paradise and taking people's intelligence for granted. I think Indian people, whether they are literate, illiterate, are a very intelligent class. Ye public hai, sab janti hai. So they know everything and they know whom to reward, how much and when.
Talking about important parts of history, you know, I was trying to research about Veer Savarkar and you happen to be some sort of expert on the topic right now, right? And you try to do and explain the whole life and importance of his work. When you Google that,
mm-hmm.
right, you Google him and you find two different school of thoughts.
Yeah.
One who are celebrating him and the other who are completely opposite.
Yeah.
Why is that? Like, why Veer Savarkar is not celebrated by a lot of people? Or let me just take it one step behind and like educate everybody. Who was Veer Savarkar and why mentioning him in history is so important that now you speak about the whole topic?
Yeah. So my entry point also, Raj, into the life of Veer Savarkar was precisely on that account that, you know, in our growing up years, I don't remember him being a part of even a mention of him in our textbooks.
Exactly.
I come from a part Maharashtrian family. So on my maternal side, in whispers, there would be some accounts of Savarkar here and there. But other than that, there was not much of a discussion about this man. But if you remember, during the first NDA government, that's when I think he burst into national consciousness all over again, when Mr. Vajpayee put up his photograph in the Central Hall of Parliament. And there was a huge furore about that. And a year later, there was also a plaque in his honor in Kalapani in Port Blair, where he was incarcerated for a long time. And there was a hullabaloo about that too. And once the NDA government fell and the UPA came, we had Mr. Manishankar Iyer have that plaque removed and thrown away, and a lot of invectives hurled against Savarkar. And especially from 2014 onwards, mm-hmm. you know, election rallies feature him. People, so many leaders, prominent leaders, make very, very disparaging comments about him. He's constantly a volleyball between, competing political parties and ideologies. Leave all the noise and politics aside. Mm. But if a young person in India today wants to know what is all this noise about, exactly what you said, like, who was the man? Why is he intruding contemporary political discourse in a manner that very few other leaders of the past do?
Yeah.
What is the source to go back to? There's hardly any scholarly work done on him. The last biography of his was written when he was alive in the 1960s by this gentleman called Mr. Dhananjay Keer. Now, since then to now, my first volume, Echoes from a Forgotten Past, came out in 2019. Till then, 40 years, 40, 50 years, there was reevaluation of him. Whereas the ideology that he propounded of Hindutva has been in a political ascent in this country. He intrudes our discourse, but an alarming lack of scholarship or of curiosity, intellectual curiosity about the person, and access to his thoughts and writings that was absent. So again, Toni Morrison played in my head that if there's a book that you want to read and it's not been written yet, you must be the first to write not one, but two volumes, because there was just so much of material about him which had been hitherto remained unaccessed by people. So that's one reason why these two volumes came up. And I've tried to, take all aspects of his life. Here was a man who And in fact, on 28th of May, we'll be commemorating 140 years of his birth in a small little village called Bhagur in Nashik, from where he grew up. And at a very, very young age, inspired by the revolutionary movement in Maharashtra, which was brewing then, the Chafekar brothers, who had protested against the plague, in Maharashtra, and the repressive measures that the British were taking to clamp down on plague victims. The Epidemics, Diseases and Epidemics Act, which was, introduced now during COVID, was actually enacted by the British then to control plague. And the Chafekars protesting against that had killed the plague commissioner. So inspired by that, young Savarkar, who was 12 years old or something, had taken this vow in front of his family deity, Ashtabhuja Bhavani, that till my very end, in Marathi, he said, Shatrus Marta Marta Mareto Zunzen. So I'm going to keep fighting till my very end, killing the enemy. And he followed this up by forming India's first ever organized secret society, or Gupta Sanstha, which was first called Rashtra Bhakta Samuha. It later morphed into Mitra Mela, which later became Abhinav Bharat, Young India, on the lines of the Italian revolutionaries, Mazzini and Garibaldi and others, who had created Young Italy to fight against imperialism. So young people who would gather together, and the idea was to create an insurrection in the British Indian Army, very similar to what happened in 1857. Mm. And this started spreading its wings all over Maharashtra first and other parts of India, and active collaboration with several other secret societies, particularly in Bengal. You had the Anushilan Samiti, the Swadhin Bharat, Jugantar, several others. So people like Aurobindo Ghosh, Barindranath Ghosh, Prafulla Chaki, Khudiram Bose, all these people were constantly working towards with each other. And imagine at a time when there were no WhatsApp groups to communicate and coordinate strategy, they were actually working together for the complete freedom of India. And Savarkar, in the Maharashtra side, he, his elder brother Baba Rao, had formed this. Mm. And in 1905, as a student in Ferguson College in Pune, he organized the first ever student bonfire against British clothes to protest against the partition of Bengal. So a young student in Maharashtra being influenced by what was happening in distant Bengal, and actually all of them organizing against it. And he was rusticated from college, fined and all that. Then he gets a scholarship, goes away to London to study law on the behest of this amazing, leader of the revolutionaries there called Shyamji Krishna Varma, who set up this India House. That place is still there in London. It's occupied by other people now, but it's the place where all these revolutionaries lived. And some of the stellar names who probably wouldn't even light a bulb in anyone's minds. Shyamji Krishna Varma, Madam Bhikaji Kama, VVS Iyer, MPT Acharya, Sardar Singh Rana, Madan Lal Dhingra, Lala Hardayal, Sikandar Hayat Khan. So many such people from different parts of India, almost like a microcosm of what India was there in India House. And as their leader, Savarkar did several things. One is he wrote a book on the 1857 revolution. He called it the first war of Indian independence. It was still then called Sepoy Mutiny, disparagingly. Some few sepoys, because of that beef lard and pork, this thing they revolted, was what the British tried to perpetuate. He said, no, this was a revolution. And that book actually became like the Bhagavad Gita for revolutionaries much later. It was Bhagat Singh who published, republished another edition of it, or later Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose and Rash Bihari Bose and others. He also got bomb manuals, how to manufacture bombs in India, all of those, sent back to India, and organized this constant, revolution for the complete liberation of India, as I said. And the first flag of Indian independence, designed by him and Hemchandra Das Kanungo of the Bengal Anushilan Samiti, that first flag was taken to the International Socialist Conference in Stuttgart in Germany in 1907. And Madam Bhikaji Kama just by a woman. Again, she jumps onto the table and unfurls that flag, you know, defying a lot of resistance from the British, and say, from today, India is independent. This is our flag. Do what you wish. You know, so that kind of zeal that they managed, and a lot of political assassinations then began to happen, whether it was in Calcutta, it was in Nashik, and in London itself, right under the nose of the British crown, Madanlal Dhingra assassinates Lord Curzon Wiley. And that's when the whole revolutionary movement unravels and Savarkar is arrested. He's tried unfairly. He's sent away to, he's given the harshest punishment of 2 life imprisonments of 50 years, 25 plus 25. So a young man who was going to London to study law at the age of 26, 27, arrested, 50 years, you know. Imagine if he has to, you know, literally rot in the dungeons of Port Blair, the most inhuman tortures, what it could have meant for his psyche. So there he's sent away to Kalapani, suffers some of the worst of tortures there. No good food, no toilet facilities, no medical facilities, that Kolhuka Bell punishment all through the day, and weathers all of that. And then in 1924, he is released. And between 24 to 37, 14 years of actual jail imprisonment, and then 13 long years of house arrest and confinement in Ratnagiri in Maharashtra. So 27 long years of a young person's life totally snuffed out. His degree snatched away from him. His entire family property taken away, you know, and even the vessels of the house were pawned and auctioned. So when the men were sent away to Kalapani, the women of the house literally begged for eking out a livelihood. So under those circumstances and sacrifices, this man, you know, survived. And in Ratnagiri, in 13 years, by then he had propounded this whole idea of Hindutva. And in the 13 years, he was a social reformer also, who looked at a complete casteless society, you know, inter-caste marriage, inter-caste dining. The first temple in India, Patit Pavan Mandir in Ratnagiri in 1931, where people of all castes could go and worship. At a time when among the Maharashtrian Brahmins, the Deshasthas and the Konkanast Chitpavans would not sit together and eat. You had the first cafe where everyone could sit together and eat, which was a revolutionary idea at 100 years ago. Yeah. Today, it doesn't matter so much in urban spaces. But then it was a big deal. And, you know, Aspruchya Ganpati, an untouchable Ganpati, where the lowest in the caste order would be the priest, and even the Brahmin had to go and take his blessings to, you know, worship. So, and children of untouchable, so-called untouchable communities, to be able to study along with the upper caste children. All these experiments he did for 13 years. And then after he was finally released in 37, he becomes the president of the Hindu Mahasabha, which was a very important party then, and made it a politically, electorally fighting fit party against both the Congress and the Muslim League, which was there. And throughout his life, he was an ideological opponent of Gandhi and what he stood for. He had a lot of differences of opinion with Gandhi. And of course, then the very difficult times leading up to the partition of the country, where the Hindu Mahasabha stoutly opposed the partition till the very end. And after freedom, he was falsely implicated in Gandhi's assassination, because Nathuram Godse was his, you know, acolyte in the Hindu Mahasabha. And so he and Narayan Apte, who were the main conspirators. And he was kept in jail, but exonerated and honorably exonerated in 1948 in the Red Fort trials. But after that, you know, the man just lost interest. He became a persona non grata in society. Even talking about him meant that, you know, you paid a heavy price with your livelihood. So he relegated to the, you know, background in society. And finally, in 1966, on 26 February, in that Jain tradition of Paryopveshan, where you stop eating, drinking, he actually gave up his life in Mumbai.
What was the ideological war between him and Mahatma Gandhi?
That's interesting. There? So you know, they met as young students when Gandhi was in South Africa and Savarkar was in London. And the fundamental difference of both these men was Gandhi by then had already crystallized his whole non-violent movement. Mira Savarkar believed in a violent armed rebellion, a revolution, and that was their fundamental difference. So when they met in London, I think in 1909, again, if my dates don't, you know, fail me, it was during the Dashera that, you know, they would organize a lot of debates and talks in the India House. And so Gandhiji had come to this place, and so he was invited to talk. And Gandhi said, you know, I'm not talking about political stuff. I'm going to talk about Ram Rajya and its establishment and how it's so important and how nonviolence is important and all that. And then he steps aside and Savarkar takes the podium. And he rebuts every aspect of what Gandhi says, saying, what is absolute nonviolence? Is it not alien to our ethos and our culture, especially the Hindu culture? All our gods and goddesses are shown with weapons in their hands. That is not for ornamentation. That is for attacking what you think as adharma. So he said, you know, even you speak of Ram Rajya, even to establish that Ram Rajya, Ram had to go to Lanka and kill Ravan after waging a war. He didn't go there and sit on Satyagraha saying, give Sita back. And he said, okay, chalo, I'll give her back to you. So he had to wage a bloody war. So establishment of Ram Rajya also is preceded by war. And we are talking this, he said, in the Dashera, when all the 9 days the Devi is celebrated, you know, killing different asuras. And even in the Gita, you have Lord Krishna saying, even if the opponent is your own father, brother, cousin, teacher, this, that, you, it's your duty, your dharmic duty to kill the person if that person is on the side of adharma. So his question was, if you consider the British Raj as adharmic, the means don't matter, the end matters, that we have to annihilate it at any cost. So I think fundamentally that was one major aspect of difference where both of them did not agree upon for the longest time, and that they will never converge. They are opposite poles of Indian history. In fact, there are two portraits in the Central Hall of Parliament. Quite ironically, they are diagonally opposite to each other. So they are almost looking at each other all the time as the two opposite poles of our freedom movement too. The other major area where they differed was what Savarkar considered as Gandhi's appeasement policy, particularly of the Muslims, and thereby facilitating or sowing the seeds of partition.
So why do you feel, why only one side, or why Mahatma Gandhi is celebrated, only he is celebrated? I definitely agree that what he has done was really important and actually led us to where we are today. But why only him? Like, why do you feel like there's only one person being celebrated so much, whereas all the other people who you just talked about, they are not celebrated as much?
They are spoken about in as footnotes in our history books, that these were some isolated, you know, acts of bravery. It was not a coordinated movement. Some young, you know, hot-blooded youngsters throwing bomb here and there and killing someone and then being executed. So that's how it's represented to us. It didn't achieve much. The political reason I mentioned, so especially after independence, and Gandhi by then had already been killed. So to make an icon of a person was politically expedient for the party that came to power after that. And to attribute everything to only this and not to all the other streams, it was just, you know, political gains, the manipulation of history, which is the biggest problem in this country, whether what we spoke earlier of medieval history or modern Indian history or even ancient India. So when history is utilized by politicians of all hues for narrow political gains of today, I think the casualty is the countries and generations that grow in it with a warped view of our own past. And that, sadly, you know, then and now it continues in different forms.
So you feel all of this, I mean, some large extent part of all these things, like having Mahatma Gandhi on the currency, having MG Road everywhere around the world, around the country.
Yeah.
Right. It's largely because of political gain.
No, I wouldn't say that, but completely. But why only him? I mean, every
exactly,
other...
Exactly, well, that's what
yeah,
I'm asking.
Yeah, so we should have... I mean, Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose was ideally, I mean, when the INA did its exploits, he was declared as the first prime minister of free India. So ideally, and I'm so glad that his statue is there at, what is now Kartavya Path, where under the canopy you had the statue of Emperor George V. Here, this was the man who helped displace that man's government. So ideally, he should have occupied that place right then. But it happened better late than never. But why so belatedly? So there are so many others. In every country, there are multiple icons on the currency note. So celebrate Gandhi. We owe a lot to him and his, concept of freedom. Some people may agree with it. Some people may not agree. A lot of harm also was caused by his ideology, which needs to be discussed. A critique is not a criticism. An honest critique of the positives, the negatives of all these leaders needs to be done dispassionately now, and celebrate all of them. Let's not give one importance over the other. Iconizing him and making him the face of it was certainly done in the aftermath of freedom, and he was not even there then. And yeah. So then to make a deity of somebody is so much more easier. So you needed the governments that came after freedom also drew their legitimacy some way through this iconization. So that I think was what it was. But there's no harm in celebrating him, because I think he's the most visible face of the way the world looks at it. And so many people have drawn inspiration from him, whether it's Nelson Mandela, whether it's so many, other countries who have, drawn inspiration and revere him. So it's perfectly fine to honor and revere him, but not at the risk of making everyone else almost, disappear from the firmament.
What were the consequences of, or what harm did Gandhi's movements cost in the country?
So I think we partially discussed that earlier, where what was Savarkar's opposition to him on this whole idea of appeasement politics. The entire the manner in which the country was vivisected on communal lines was largely a manifestation of decades of this very policy. Directly or indirectly, somewhere, who takes the blame for the millions displaced and killed and all that happened during partition? If you are taking the credit for the liberation of the country, you also need to take the liability of all the negatives. You can't just cherry pick and say only the positives belong to me, the negatives are someone else's. Mm. So when one looks at that, this inability to understand the roots of separatism, specifically Muslim separatism, which was already brewing in India right from the 18th century, the Wahhabi movements, Sir Syed Ahmad Khan and the two-nation theory that he propounded, the AMU, Aligarh Muslim University, the establishment of the Muslim League, the Morelamento reforms that came, the Lucknow Pact, separate electorates, the communal electorate bill that came, all these, somewhere the Congress was playing along and not countering it. And the partition was only the last episode in this long phase of appeasement. And this inability to understand that, I think, was a great failure, which one must call out and say, this is what it is. It's a historical fact. So one needs to mention it where it needs to be told. So that, I would say, was a very sad, episode.
So what would, now you're talking about separation and how all the things that it caused, and we keep hearing about it, but we never actually hold anyone accountable for that, because we have never been told or taught or even just talked about the awareness of the fact that this happened because of XYZ person and XYZ group of people. If this wouldn't have happened, how do you imagine Akhand Bharat? Like, what would be the dynamics of Akhand Bharat today?
Oh my God, it would be so unwieldy and unmanageable with such a huge territory. In retrospect, maybe it was the right thing to do. But I think, Raj, I think the more fundamental question that needs to come is, you know, when even Sir Syed Ahmed or even Dr. Ambedkar talked of this as a clash of civilizations.
Hmm.
What is the Indic worldview? You know, in the Indian faith systems, there are different schools of philosophy, right? In India, Bharat, that, you know, you have the Astic traditions or the Orthodox and the Nastic traditions, the heterodox.
Hmm.
But on the other side, you know, you have largely the Abrahamic faiths, which say there is only one my way or the highway. If you do not believe in my understanding of what the ultimate supreme reality is, then you are a non-believer, you are called names. And there are also, you know, prescribed, you know, actions that can legitimately be taken against the non-believer, the pagans, the kafirs, all these people, to kill them, to destroy their, you know, places of worship, to destroy their centers of learning, to, you know, molest, rape their women. It's all considered as part of religious sanction, right? And to convert them either by force or allurements or anything is par for the course. So when these two kind of very different, these are different worldviews as to how you see the universe and the answers to the universe, who is the supreme reality, you are not the knower, you are the seeker. And that's why in our Indian philosophy, it was neti neti. This is not the end. There is further scope for finding out. And everybody is a sadhak, everybody is a seeker. Compare that to say there is only one God sitting in a high sky. He's controlling, he's, you know, monitoring every action of yours. If you don't believe in him, he's going to throw a thunderbolt at you. You're going to be rotting in hellfire. You'll be put in a cauldron of oil and burnt. And these type of things are a different worldview. So when these two clash, which is what I think all these people called as a clash of civilizations, clash of ideas, because all religions are eventually a movement of ideas. Their founders or the way it developed is a lifestyle, it's an idea. These are very two different worldviews which collided. And in different parts of the world, the other worldview, the Greek, the Roman, all these other, you know, traditions completely got eliminated. Whereas India is probably the only tradition which still survives. Our faith systems, our, you know, languages, our rituals, traditions continue after so many centuries of, you know, trying to annihilate them. And so when we look at even these traditions and rituals and all of that, we just dismiss them away as mumbo jumbo, superstition and this and that. As a historian, I look at them also as a very archival, you know, treasure which we have inherited. The same thing would have been done 5,000, 6,000 years ago by our ancestors, which we are also continuing to do. And how did these survive? Through word of mouth, despite the destruction of our centers of learning. All our universities, whether it was Nalanda, Takshashila, Vikramshila, all these universities were burnt and torn down. When Bakhtiar Khilji, you know, destroyed Nalanda, it is said that the place burnt for 6 months. That was the amount of manuscripts and knowledge that was there. But despite all of that, today our knowledge systems, whatever it is, you know, our philosophy, our knowledge systems, yoga, Ayurveda, all these are still surviving. So what is that strength of this this landmass, this bhubhag, which even Iqbal, I think in his this thing, kuch to hai ki hasti mitti nahi hamari, he said. What is that kuch? Is it tangible? Is it only physical prowess, like I document in Brave Hearts of Bharat? Or is there a civilizational strength which we inherit? And can that become a source of strength for the future? That, you know, we have managed to protect and preserve despite all odds. And how do you then also deal with those forces and ideologies which do not believe in your egalitarian Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, the whole world is one family and all of that, vis-a-vis people who say ours is a club. It's an if you don't have membership to this club, you will be punished. You will sit out of the class. So how do you deal with that? And I think whether it was a partition of the country also, or the continuing conflicts we are seeing, not only in India, but in different parts of the world, is a manifestation of this very, you know, clash. Unless those groups, those faiths and communities try to reform and say that those are, you know, edicts and verses and traditions of the 8th century, 9th century, some of it is not relevant today, at least in this country, they will not be accepted. Unless that happens, the friction and clashes are inevitable. And one needs to understand that. And I think Dr. Ambedkar very clearly understood it in his book, Pakistan and Thoughts on Partition. He also said the same. He said, Hindus and Muslims cannot live together in this country. So when there is partition, there needs to be a complete transfer of populations. Everybody goes to one side. It's like two brothers in a house fighting. So if the younger brother wants to separate the property division, let him take and go away and not have anything to do with this. And so that was what he had advocated, because that's probably he understood this problem very clearly, that how this was actually a very deep inbuilt, you know, fallacies between the two worldviews of how we look at human beings itself, how we look at the universe, how we look at God, creation, and everything that flows from it.
But can't it happen that two people with different ideologies can live in harmony?
We can.
Because now it's happening in few places, few areas, few communities.
No, we can and we should. But the onus of that is on whom? The onus of that is not on the person always. And that was again the Gandhian problem. The onus of on that is not on the person who already says Ekam Sat Vipra Bahudha Vadanti, who already believes that there are many paths to that truth. If we have so many different devis and devtas, adding one more, you know, Allah or Jesus or anybody is not a big deal. We would allow everything to pass by. The onus of that harmony is on those who speak of exclusivist clubs, who speak that we are the gospel truth. Where is the need to convert? Where is the need to, if someone is doing it out of conviction, perfectly fine. But mass conversions, obviously that's not through any kind of, you know, conviction. It is allurement. Of course, people would attribute it to caste oppressions that for centuries, which is a reality which needs to be accepted, that for centuries, there was also that perverse aspect of this society where all this knowledge, all this high philosophy, which I just narrated, was kept away from a large section of the people. But multiple waves that happened in Indian society, Hindu society particularly, constantly stood for reforms on this front, right?
Like, what's your take on changing names of the cities? Like, it's say, we will name the city the way we want and you have to accept it.
But why shouldn't we? As I said, Nalanda was burnt by Bakhtiar Khilji. Nalanda, all these universities were our Princeton, Stanford, Harvard's of those times. Mm. People from other countries would come here, whether it was Fahian, Hyunsang, all these people. Now, Bakhtiar Khilji destroyed that place. Now, you come out of Nalanda, this the place there is Bakhtiarpur. Now, tell me, is there any other country in the world which valorizes and makes a hero of someone who destroyed your center of learning and actually celebrates him or her? So today, if those mistakes of history are being corrected, what is particularly wrong about it? Aurangzeb was a monster of his times. If he needs to be deplatformed, so to say, so be it. I mean, Dara Shikoh, his brother, was a better example to follow. So name things after him if you wish. But why celebrate barbarians? Why celebrate in my state, in Karnataka, they had this perverse, and maybe it will come back now that the Congress is back in power. You had this Tipu Jayanti against a 18th century very bigoted ruler, Tipu Sultan, who unleashed, you know, unimaginable horrors on so many people, Syrian Christians, the Konkanis of Mangalore, the Mandya Mayengars, all anybody who did not belong to his faith. Now, why commemorate and celebrate the Nayars of Malabar in Kerala who hate him, the Koorgis, the in Koorg, the Kodavas? In Koorg, they say even a stray dog is disparagingly called Tipu, to, you know, that's the amount of hatred that is there after 250 years. So why celebrate such a person? In Karnataka itself, there is a, you know, Sufi kind of a saint called Sant Shishunal Sharif. If you want to make a particular community feel very nice and have its icons. First of all, I don't agree to that. Why should a particular community have icons of the same community? A Hindu need not have only a Hindu as an icon. He can have a Muslim, Christian, whatever as their role model. Likewise for everyone else. But if you really want to have, you have a lot of these Tara Shikoh and Shishunal Sharif, Rahim, Ras Khan, to, you know, Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam, to Arif Muhammad Khan, KK Muhammad. There are so many others who can be held up as, the role models. So why celebrate barbarians? Why celebrate people who have destroyed your Bharatiya civilization? Why? And if that is being changed, why is that wrong?
Thank you for our first history podcast, giving us so much perspective. So, like, such a great perspective on so many things, sparking my curiosity and my users and my viewers' curiosity as well. Thank you so much. I'm grateful that we did this episode. I was so worried and nervous about this that will I be able to hold a conversation, because my knowledge in this domain is so limited that I was super worried that would this be a good experience for you? Would you feel some kind of naiveness in my conversation? I'm sure you must have sensed it, but
no.
I am glad that I was able to do this, and I did it with you because you just sparked a new curiosity in me that I'm going to keep having these kind of guests more.
Wonderful.
So thank you so much
thank
for being
you so
here.
Much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for watching this episode. Please let us know that whether you like these kind of episodes or no, because we're trying to experiment and get as many guests as we can from different genres who can teach us about history, about past, about future, about politics, about business, about everything that is important for us to understand and learn in order to become a better suited person to achieve all his or her dreams. Let me know if you like the guest today. And if you have any suggestions, please let us know in the comments and share this episode with at least one person who may need it, who may benefit from it. Until the next episode, keep figuring out.